Hi, good morning and welcome. This is Seek Sustainable Japan. I'm JJ Walsh, your host in Hiroshima, joined by the amazing Thomas Klepfer at Pitchfork Farms, also in Hiroshima. Thanks for joining, Thomas.
Good morning. Hi.
Now you're in your office. Tell us about your teaching since you're there.
Yeah, currently I teach at Onomichi City University. It's pretty close to my farm. I teach Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And have been teaching English here part-time for the last 3 or 4 years. And currently, from this semester, we'll be teaching an agricultural course, which I'm excited about. It's something I'm really hoping to get the students involved in this project we've got going here. So
that's awesome. I know so many of the organic farmers in Japan that I talk with, a big part of what they do is like farm tours like you do, but also being in the education system, teaching future generations of farmers. We need more of that, right, Thomas?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I think most parts of the world, but especially in Japan, depopulation is happening, but on a greater scale in the agriculture sector. So there's definitely not enough farmers, which is why we're seeing maybe increased prices in food in a lot of ways, and more farmland abandonment every single year. So,
yeah, there was an estimate that there's only about 1 million farmers now.
Less than that, I think.
Less?
Yeah.
I think that was 2024's rate. And then there was an estimate that by 2050, we would have only 200,000 farms in Japan. That is not enough, right?
Right. Right. Certainly not enough for a country that's currently importing about 70% of its food. And then if you include seeds in that, it's probably even more. Then you go into fertilizers and look at the production of a lot of how food is produced. It requires a lot of inputs from other places. So, yeah, having more and more people involved would help. I think the common thought is that AI or robots will solve these problems, but the reality is probably not so true. And we'll also have to rely maybe heavily on immigration as well to do some of the lifting and heavy lifting for farming. So there's multiple factors.
Absolutely. And you've been farming in Japan for 15 years,
right?
But you are a very young farmer. Most of the average age of farmers, I think, is almost 70, right? 69.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You must meet a lot of other farmers around Japan or connect with them, and a lot of people are retiring. It's time, right?
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of farmlands and farmers that we'll see more and more abandonment, I think, with no future predecessor. So.
Yeah. Now, at the university, you've started some experimental plots. Tell us about that. That sounds exciting.
Right. When I came to the university, it's up in the northern part of Onomichi, about 20 minutes or so by a bus or by car from the station. And it's up in the mountains. It used to be a women's university. And then I think in the mid-2000s, this area became a university for Onomichi City. And it's surrounded by rice fields and terraced farms. And actually, when I first got to Japan in 2011 as an ALT, as on the JET program, I was invited by a farmer here, and I did my first tawe here. I did my first rice planting here around this university. I saw this university building. I was like, oh, that's an interesting looking big brick building. You don't see many of those in Japan. And turns out it was the university, and I didn't think much of it. Didn't know I'd be working here 15 years later. But as we cycled up and cycled back down to Onomichi City, yeah, I had just done my first rice planting here. But actually, the majority of the farms now are not in production and it completely abandoned. So I was considering, and I got really motivated and inspired last year to go to one of the advisor's office and say, I want to start an agricultural program. I want to start something here. I do enjoy teaching, and I do enjoy teaching English, but I recently graduated from Hiroshima University with a doctorate degree now, and I want to be able to build some kind of agricultural program and get some experience and get students some experience, because I find too, it's an interesting point that there's not much to do up here in this rural part of Onomichi, but there's so many fields available and so much available. Surely there's something that we could rent. So looking further into it, I found that Onomichi has an Akiya, or they have an Akiya bank, but they also have a agricultural bank, or a no nochi bank, agricultural land bank. So when I looked into that, was able to find a few plots that were available just a few minutes away from the university. And I approached the farmer and approached the university about this. And I also had to go to the Shiaksho or City Hall to talk with them about this. And sure enough, the land that I wanted would be available. And the farmer was very willing. He's 85 years old, the owner, and he had been actually tilling it for us for several years, which was great. So it was like a fresh canvas basically to start on, which I felt very lucky, because my farm actually started a very weedy and messy farm, and it was nice to kind of start off something like this. So I applied last year in September. I went to the city hall to apply for this plot, and it's two rice fields. So I haven't really grown on rice fields before, but when I first thought about it, because it was September, October was coming up, and I could do a crop of wheat and barley and also some cover crops. So I put those two crops in, those two main crops in, and this was even before the contract had started. So the contract began in December, technically. But the farmer is really, really nice and very supportive. It starts off with having tea and cake or coffee at his house, and sitting there and getting to know him and getting to know stories of the land, because he's been farming on that property for 80 years. I mean, his family, even before him and probably a generation before that, had been farming this land for years. And to see these rice fields and terraces, which put, is generations worth of work into, to see them abandoned, seems, the Japanese expression, multi and I, it seems like what a waste. And to have such a youthful population so close by with the university students, how do we get them involved for this local initiative? So that's something I have been passionate about and really wanted to get going. And now we thought we might have maybe five students joining. It's an elective course. We actually have 20 students joined. So yeah, I'm excited. I'm also nervous because I haven't run a class like this before. It's a bit of a hybrid. Even today's lecture will incorporate this YouTube feed. So students will afterwards watch it. They'll have some homework, of course, where they'll need to think of some questions and answer some questions based on this YouTube. I don't know how well they can understand all of the English that that'll come up today's
That's
broadcast.
awesome. I love that you're incorporating your interviews. Now you've been interviewed by NHK, local media, local TV. So you've got a lot of sources that they can draw on in Japanese and of course today in English. Now, one of the things that Chuck talks about, organic farmer who was just on the show a couple weeks ago, is that it's great to take over rice farms because they're already set up for irrigation and how difficult it is to get water usually through the farms. Your hillside farm in Mukaishima, I remember you talking about during the summer when it's so hot, having enough water on your fields was a big issue. So is irrigation easier on this old rice farm?
I think it will be. I think this is the other issue with abandoned farmland too, though, is that and I think nobody has been maintaining this space, and that's something I've been communicating with the owner of the land about. Is he said, "Oh yeah, this area did have some drainage, but it seems like there's some problems there. We almost are getting too much. We had some pretty heavy rain on 2 weeks ago, just before Golden Week, and it was the first day I brought my students out to see the fields, and we get there, and it is a rice field, now. It's a rice paddy. And I'm like, didn't expect this much water, you know? So that management part is going to be crucial if we're going to actually be able to get out. But I went out there today, and it looks like we've got several weeks ahead with pretty sunny weather. So I think we should be okay. But then again, in the summertime, after the rainy season, yeah, it should make it easier because where I farm in Hishio in Mukaishima, it doesn't rain in August and September, which causes a pretty significant issue for me farming there. So yeah, it
I
should
know
be.
you had rain catchment systems set up around the farm, right?
A little bit, yeah, a little bit. But I'm mostly on well water, so I can run sprinkler and irrigation. I have used drip line in the past. I might go through and set that up this season. I haven't really played with it too much. The other side of farming in my region is that we can farm year round. So I've taken to taking a bit of a break in August and September. Maybe now with this new property that I might not have that long of a break. Or like you've said, having this irrigation system in place, if I open that channel up when the rain is when we're in a bit of a drought period, then maybe I could manage getting some fall, winter carrots, cabbage, etc. In up here, and the climate might be a little bit cooler as well because we're up on a mountainside as opposed to right by the sea. So,
Nice. Now, one thing, I'm really excited to see your farm. It's been a while since I've been out. So I'm going to come out this week, Sunday, and then I'll catch people up with some video from the farm, which will be really fun. But when I visited last time, you were just starting to plant citrus again. And you had taken over an old, there was a lot of citrus, but a lot of it wasn't really fruiting anymore. It looks like you've had good harvests of citrus now.
Right. Yeah, we've been growing probably lemon, lime, mekan. In the picture here, you've got amanatsu. And this amanatsu actually came from two or three trees that were just below the farm. So that's been really great. We're currently taking orders for boxes of citrus. We're selling it around 5 kg, so it's 20 to 25 citrus. And they're, of course, there's no pesticides, no herbicides, no fertilizer actually is used in the production side. So even the peel can be used. A lot of customers have been making jams with these as well. So we have a really kind of bumper crop right now. Last year was a slower crop. But this year of this citrus, particularly, it's called Amanatsu, and amai means sweet in Japanese, and natsu, summer, so sweet summer. So it actually sweetens up as you store it through and into the summer. This weekend we had a tour, and for the tour we offer a welcome drink. So we made lemonade with it because we have planted lemons, we have planted limes, but those are still 4 or 5 years. So we expect within the next 3 to 4 years, we'll have a lot more of these. But this amanatsu, particularly this citrus, was planted maybe 30 or 40 years ago and has done well. One of the best producers that I've got, which is probably planted 8 years ago now, has been grapefruit. So I just grew one tree, and I think I got 50 to 100 fruits off that this year. The previous year was the bumper crop year, so it was about 100 fruits off that first year, and it's been really great. But that's citrus trees, fruit trees. Yeah, you're always 6, 7 years in waiting, and you get your real first big harvest about 6, 7 years in. So yeah, we're looking forward to those. But we have gotten some mekan, and when we do boxes through the winter, we're putting some of these mekan or satsuma or mandarin oranges in our boxes and trying to have lots of variety. And I've really enjoyed having those as well. So.
That's awesome. Now, you often talk about your farm on the hill in Mukashima. You have a very special weather you can grow year round. But like you said, a bit too hot and not enough rain in summer is a challenge, right?
Right. Yeah. So a lot of the crops that we do grow, that I really like growing, especially are during this April, May June time. It's salad greens, it's leafy greens. Yeah, this is a good example. This is looks like a mid-May photo. And it's radishes, it's sorbamame or fava beans, it's fennel, it's arugula flowers, it's kale, Swiss chard, coriander, onions, all of that's coming in at once. And it's really exciting time to be on the farm, especially this season. It's my favorite. So when you get that variety and diversity, it's great. Summer season comes and we're looking at tomatoes, eggplants, beans, peppers, corn, zucchini, pumpkins. And they're great, but I think some of the crops and some of the variety you get is a bit more challenging. And I really do like having, cool, refreshing salads and greens, in that time too. But it's really pushing the limits of those crops because a lot of crops are not that heat resistant, heat tolerant. So we've had to diversify and choose crops that do grow really well in those kind of environments. And for some of our customers, it's crops that they might not be familiar with, things like morojeya or kushinsai, which is a Chinese green, things that don't really offer some of the variety and refreshing taste that a salad would bring in the summer. But that's what we have to work with. And yeah, having that variety, a lot of those crops are drought tolerant, so we can still grow them, but just not in the volume that I typically like to grow, especially in this season.
I love that you always have such beautiful salads. You found some good collaborations with local restaurants and cafes that use your salads. I love that you've got this upcycled old drum from a laundry machine, and that's how you spin out the salads after you wash them. It's amazing.
Yeah, the drum's still kicking. It's, a few years ago, I guess, I had to ask the owner or the owner operator of this engineering company to come by and look into it again, because I think I'd moved it and a switch was got unplugged or something happened. But yeah, it's great and it's really nice because the quality of the produce just lasts that much longer. We can give right now we have two restaurants in Onomichi, a brand new one called Arbor, which is a hotel, and they have a pub and brunch breakfast place. And then the other one, which has been really great, Holland Village Cafe, which is a new organic focused kind of farm to table restaurant on the hill of Onomichi. These two places are really enjoying our salads, and it's really great to work with customers who appreciate us and then make the most of what we're trying to produce. So that's
That's
been helpful.
awesome. How do people find you? Like, do you find the most effective way is through your Instagram page for people to find you?
Yeah, that has been really great. Instagram, less so on Facebook these days, but Instagram has been a much better way of people. Just I think that, and then of course YouTube. Last year we had a YouTube channel, Setochi Box, came out and did a really nice 30-minute, 25-minute or so video, and that brought more orders. And new customers and people who wanted to come and see the farm themselves. So we've actually had several tours over the last several months that have been from that, which is great. And then even we had a couple from living in the UK, but had seen that YouTube video and they were really excited to come by. They had rented cycles and came out, and that's another great way. I think it keeps this idea concept of sustainability really solid. And yeah, so those have been some
Absolutely.
ways. And there were other ways. I'm on Tabechoku, which is a sales site for kind of like a social media for farmers, small scale farmers who don't necessarily sell wholesale or through supermarkets or through the JA. So we sell on Tabechoku farm. Our products can be there. And then Jalan more recently. I was on Jalan a few years ago for tours, and we just hosted our first tour after several years, I guess, was yesterday. So that was another way that people can come out and see the farm and do a tour. And yesterday we harvested some garlic and potatoes with the customers. So that was a lot of fun.
That's awesome. And it's also, I mean, it's tourism, it's income for you, which is important, but it's also education. It's a great way to share insights about what you're doing. A lot of people, I'm sure, are really surprised about the no-till method, right? So just for people who aren't aware, just quickly, can you describe how you do farming no-till? What does that look like?
Right. So I think it would go back to the book that I read in undergrad, which was Fukuoka-san's book, The One Straw Revolution. And he talked about no-till farming. And we always have these ideas that farming involves, you know, big machinery, tractors, or even rototillers. Or in Japan, it would be using a kuwa, basically a fork that you would dig the soil with and soften it up. But actually, what we've been doing the last several years, we use this, the pitchfork that's posted here. And we use that to actually fork the bed. We aerate the soil and keep a lot of what are good things about the soil in place. A lot of the microbes, a lot of the good bacteria, a lot of the earthworms and roly-polies can stay intact and continue to live in a soil that hasn't been tilled. And so we've been practicing that for, I would say, 10 years now. And in order to address like compost or fertilizing our beds, we can use a little bit of compost that we either make ourselves, or we would add a little bit of field dressing with some kind of cow manure compost. Yeah, this is an example of compost that I've made for myself at the farm. This is from a few years back, but this is probably a mix of cow manure compost that we've purchased in, plus scraps, food scraps, grasses, grains, nuka, you name it. There's a lot of different things. We try not to put any animal waste in the compost because they don't break down as much. So that's one thing we avoid, but otherwise, and also citrus, I don't really compost citrus that much. We have a lot of citrus on the farm, but the acidity I've heard makes it difficult to break down. So if you ever made a compost pile, you might find those peels still in there and it changes the pH. So typically I actually, because we have a place for fire pit, I'll burn actually the waste of citrus and then actually apply the ash back into the field there. So we're using that, but yeah, this no-till method from Fukuoka, I think it works in a lot of ways. The difference between the new property and my property is that this one has been tilled, but I'm going to slowly transition it some to no-till. But again, it's all experimentation. I think, you know, you can't hold on to this idea that, oh, I'm just going to be a no-till farmer forever, because I think it doesn't always work. And, you know, it's also, we haven't brought this up, but I've got animals as well. So sheep that I have on the farm, we'll bring them. Yeah, this is our sheep here. And they love to eat the grass. We'll put them in new plots, new areas, and they'll go through and mow it for us, right? And they're pretty heavy, though. And they like to sit around and stamp around and be in the same area for a while. And that actually compacts the soil because they're pretty heavy animals. And you bring them into the same area enough, there is some soil compaction. So, and they'll manure the field. So we actually find that tilling those fields are going to be better. But the areas that they haven't been in, or the areas that I've been doing no-till in, have turned into really prosperous areas of the farm. I'm also doing some raised beds too, and raised beds as well. You wouldn't be necessarily tilling raised beds, so I'm forking those, and those have been really great.
Recently at the Minka Summit, I was able to moderate a talk by Ian Davey, and he's doing so many amazing sustainable initiatives in his house, in the taking over abandoned farmland, similar to what you're doing. And he uses goats. Mm-hmm. And then uses goat milk. And I know you used to do goats, but recently you're doing sheep. Mm-hmm. Is there a reason you're not using goats anymore?
Yeah, for us, you know, We didn't really, the goats that we had weren't really bred for milking, and milking always seemed a bit of a chore. They just weren't used to it, and then we weren't ever gonna process the goats for meat. We never had that intention. And then one of the other challenges with goats is that, typically people will put them on a lead and have them tied up somewhere, and they'd often get tangled up, or something would happen, and so then if they were free, the fences that we have to keep the boars out, well, that wouldn't necessarily keep the goats out. They can jump, and we haven't really used electric fencing. I know a lot of people will use electric net, but on our hill, it's since it's not a flat property, it's really difficult to move these electric nets around, I would imagine. So we've never used those, and the fences we have now work for both wild boar and for the sheep. So we moved away from goats and went with the sheep, and that's been much, much easier to manage. And the sheep are also can be tied on a lead, and that seems to be okay if we're there through the day. But when I'm not at home, like here at the university, I've got them fenced in, and that's much easier. I know that they're going to be there, they're not going to jump the fence, and it's just a much easier management thing. And then we get the wool, and the wool has been really exciting to have with the farm, because we have done workshops now where we teach people about sheep shearing. I use traditional scissors or blades to shear, and here's an example of teaching people, getting them hands-on. Many of the customers, of course, have never sheared a sheep. I mean, it's not something you get to do really at all. You might have seen a shear sheeping experience or practice, but this is really a hands-on workshop for customers, and it's really exciting. So we do that every year at Golden Week. We just finished a successful workshop where we hosted about 10 people at the farm, and it was really nice. And it's kids to adults got a chance to touch the sheep, use the scissors, and have this experience. We have looked into doing some spinning workshops where we'll spin it into fibers. Potentially, we could be doing some dyeing as well, where we can dye the fabrics, and hopefully we'll get into that maybe at workshops in the future, once we kind of get a little bit more familiar with using the raw material.
That's
But then,
awesome.
yeah, I've also used it for mulching in the beds, which has been really something different too. It's just having additional materials on the farm, something that we couldn't use last year. We were mulching or putting down on the ground to prevent weeds from coming up, and actually keeping the soil moist, and keeping weeds down, and keeping the soil healthy. So
So
this is
that's a good alternative to that plastic that a
right.
lot of farmers use, right?
Right. Yeah, a lot of farmers in Japan, and we're seeing that now. I think this issue with maybe with Iran and the Middle East always puts pressure on all sectors of agriculture, from fertilizer to the plastics that are mostly used in both packaging and in, of course, the film mulch that's used in most of the fields. I would say it's great to have these weed pressure. This it's great to have something that's going to, keep the weeds down. That being said, the cost of those are going to continue to go up, and consumers will see that in the supermarket. So.
I was really pleased. Years ago, I had visited John Stollenmeyer's renovated, beautiful house in Okayama, and he talked about importing wool to use as insulation when he did his renovation. So recently, I did a little renovation, and I asked, "I don't suppose you could use wool, like instead of the synthetic material, which is more common?" And they researched it, and they were able to find it, like Japanese wool as insulation. So that's another exciting new development. We can use these natural materials, which are better for the environment, but also they're here because people like you are doing sheep as
Right.
part of your farming, right?
Right. And that's actually, this has come up recently too, because we had at our house, I live in a what was a citrus storage shed. It's kind of like a smaller kominka in some senses. It's got traditional tsuchikabe, or the adobe or clay sand straw walls. And it, but it's also got some of the issues that you'd find in these older homes where there's some gaps and spaces, especially in the ceiling. Now, you could cover that up with something, but houses are, they're made to breathe to a certain point. So we don't want to necessarily cover it up or plaster over that, because that's how the house breathes. Air comes in and out. So what was suggested recently was actually using wool. So I've got some wool that's been washed, and we did have, we use this like a, this rolled polyester, and I found that actually the wind would come through and just blow that out. So what we're going to end up doing, I think this year, is going to, in some of that, in some of those gaps, actually use our wool that's been washed. And we could even, if we wanted to get creative, we could dye it a certain color and have, you know, nicer colors that would maybe would match the interior of the house. And we could put that in the, in place of this polyester foam that
that's
really
awesome.
Actually isn't working. So,
and then if you use something like the fermented persimmon dye, mm-hmm. which is often used on wood,
right.
That as similar to indigo dye also repels insects.
Right.
And so that insects. Would maybe work really well with wool.
Yeah, it would definitely repel insects and rodents possibly as well, because I think that could be another challenge is dealing with that as well. So yeah, I think there's a lot of natural alternatives, and it's just a matter of talking to the right person, doing a little bit of research and finding what's out there and available. And what's great with, again, with the sheep and with wool is that we've got these raw materials that we can use. So, yeah.
I know that you got a loom from right. Wendy Bigler, right? Have you been able to put it to use?
No, that's that was, what, two years ago. Yeah, 2 years ago we got it. We haven't been using it. It's one of those things where we've got, there's one of our friends who's just recently moved in into our neighborhood. It's an alternative preschool that she's one of the teachers there. She's taught me a little bit with spinning, so it's just a matter of learning a little bit more spinning and getting that technique down, and then maybe going into using the table loom that we've got. She also gave us a few, Wendy gave us a few Navajo like hand looms as well, so I'd like to use those. It's also a matter of just timing and getting everything settled in. So yeah.
In this year's Japan Travel Awards, there was a special prize given to a guy who started a guest house in an old renovated minka. Mm. And he also saved like 20 looms from abandoned houses in the area. Mm. And so part of the stay is people learn how to use the loom, and then during their stay, they can go use it however they like, you know, and some people really love it. They spend 2 days, you know.
Who was that, by the way?
I'll find the name. I'll give you the link and I'll put it below.
He's not in like Saitama Prefecture.
I can't remember exactly where he is. But what a great idea, right? Mm-hmm. Like a really unique part of your stay mm-hmm. is using local wool in your case, and then using the loom. That would be maybe something you could add in the future.
Right.
There's so many great ideas out there. Right?
Right. I think for doing some of the workshops that we've been doing as well, I think this is something that we would like to do in the future for sure.
That's awesome. Now, one other thing in terms of farming, which is so important for sustainable farming and sustainable food, is seed saving. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit? And how do you do that? What time of year? That kind of thing?
Right. So every year, depending on the variety that we've got, we do save a little bit of seeds. And doing what's considered natural farming, a lot of seeds actually just come back up on the farm. I have sections of the farm kind of separated out. So yeah, in this picture on the front, we have soramame or fava beans. The wheat on the right is actually has been now reseeded into our larger field here at the university. And then the whiter seed is garlic seed that I've been saving for the last several years. This year, I only planted garlic that was saved from us. Another great example is the peas, the green peas, and the quinasaya. We harvest them at a baby or a younger stage, and then a more mature stage. And when we do that, we actually will keep some of the crops on, and then we'll save that seed for the following year. And this seed, this is actually usually used for rice or grains, but it can be used for all types of seeds. So we're using that usually in late May, early June. We try to get there before the rainy season or after the rainy season. As I mentioned, my area that I live in is very dry in July and August in terms of no rain. It's very humid because it's Japan, but it is very dry in terms of limited precipitation. So we can still save seeds then. And
what a cool machine. How does this work? So this is hand turned.
It's a hand crank there in the right side, the lower right part of the picture. And then you just put in your seeds or your material in the top. There's a little shaft in the middle part where you can open and close a door. And then you slowly open the door and let the seeds slowly come out while you're rotating the crank on the right. And then the seeds that you want to save, they usually drop in this first slot at the very bottom. And then the lighter material will actually shoot out. But occasionally the seeds will shoot out a little bit with it too. So I try to set this. What's nice is this is completely mobile. And so I can shoot this around different parts of the farm. And then the seeds that don't quite make it into the ones I'm trying to save end up getting shot out into a part of or corner of the farm. And then the next year, actually, that's where I'll harvest seeds from that, because it's a crop that if it makes it and does well, then we'll have food there for the following season. What's nice about natural farming is a lot of and saving seeds is seeds know when to germinate. You know, they really do. So it'll be too hot in August and September and it'll rain, but still seeds will not come out, and you'll have so many seeds in the ground that maybe a few will germinate and will die off because of the heat, but the ones that stick around will come back and germinate, and then the subsequent year in the spring they'll go to flower and the process starts all over again. So we've been doing the natural seed saving style or the actual collection of seeds for 10 years now. And with tools like that, it makes it much easier and you can really separate out what you want. But a lot of beans, grains, certain varieties that we don't save, but this year I did save some Roma tomatoes from last year, last crop, and got some germination off that. So that'll go into the field as well. And it's just always exciting, something to try, something to do, and something I hope to be teaching in this next this semester with the students too.
That's awesome. How much of your seeds are you self-sufficient versus how many seeds do you still need to buy?
Well, in this new crop or this new field that we've got, those are all seeds that have been saved. So I've got wheat, barley, rye, peas, all from saved seeds. Soybeans are all saved. But then for the like the pictures you just showed, some of these are not are seeds that I purchased, like eggplant, mizuna, kale, hokusai. So these are ones that I typically don't save because I'm harvesting the entire plant. The baby leaf packages at the top, I didn't save. Typically wouldn't save because they're crops that I'm trying to get high rotation out of. Cabbages, I might not want to necessarily save, but some varieties I might. Like there's some interesting varieties from another company that I purchased from, but I typically buy seeds from three companies at this point. And there's always varieties that look new or exciting or different. I think this year I saw red eggplants that I've never heard of, never seen. And I planted those in the raised beds this year, really close to the house. And I don't even know what they're going to taste like, but they'll be exciting, to have and something new. So, you know, it's like, I think some people, you know, these days I know really made a comeback. I know that of course it's worth, you know, they're worth a lot of money. It's Pokemon and Pokemon cards, right? A lot of people are collecting these, right? For me, it's seeds, you know, so I'm always looking at new varieties and always wanting to challenge what's available on the catalogs. And I probably have purchased close to 70 or 80 varieties this year, maybe more. I don't really keep track, because it's part of the fun is having diversity.
Yeah, that makes it more interesting for you. You're also growing some things that maybe you don't see so much in Japan, right. Like some of the things like Swiss chard.
Swiss chard, beets. Right? Yes, things that I can't get at the supermarket. And kale, it's one of the things you're starting to see it a little bit more now, but it's one of my staple crops. It really is hardy and it's something I eat every day. So this is another reason why I would choose to grow some of these things, is because it's something I want to eat every day. So,
and I think also that comparison between goats and sheep, you were saying sometimes the goats were a bit finicky about what they wanted to eat,
right?
But the sheep will basically eat all the cuttings or leftover things or grasses, right?
Yeah, for the most part. And you know, one of the issues too with goats is they're not, what we found too is that they don't really like the rain at all. And if they're out in the rain for too long, they got sick. I think we lost a goat once because of that. And, you know, Japan doesn't really have vets that can take care of farmland animals so quickly or so regularly. And that's a really big challenge for having animals in Japan, especially these sheep or goats. For larger livestock like cow, yeah, but you would never, you know, at this point in Japan, you know, other countries maybe, but you wouldn't just have one cow, you know. You might, but it'd be pretty rare. And so, yeah, I think this was another big challenge that we had. But our sheep have been really, really great and really, really hardy and resilient. So,
I know that something that you also do with seminars and workshops is like talking about how to shear a sheep more gently or more ethically, so you're not scaring the animal. Mm-hmm. I know that you also talk about ethical slaughter. Mm-hmm. Can you touch on that a little bit? Because that is connected to animal welfare, being sustainable as a farmer. You want to make sure your animals are not tortured, or they have quality of life as well, right?
Right. Yeah, I think that's something, you know, even as, you know, something maybe we don't really consider as well as it's a wild boar as well. There's so many, you know, you would trap it and, you know, yeah, how you put it down really is something you have to consider and think about. And it's not an easy process. It's why, like, you know, with the sheep, I think I've processed 3 at this point, and it's not something I want to do every year, and it's not something I want to do all the time. And it's something you have to, you know, really have reverence for when you do it, because, it's, yeah, it makes you appreciate it much, much, much more when you have that experience. And it's the same with the chickens as well. I think we've processed a few on the farms, but it's never been like the main goal, the main intention behind having the animals as well. Same with Buchan or the pig. There's no way I had considered it before. I think we had gotten busy and I thought, oh, if I didn't do the, you know, if I didn't have the Buchan, I might be able to do something or travel more or something, you know, I don't know. But it just, you know, at this point, it's a big responsibility and it's something I need. I maybe didn't think about before I had it. And I would say anybody wanting to get farm animals is that it is a big responsibility. And when you have them and when you raise them on your farm, for me at this point, it's really hard to just give it away or say, it's kind of with me for its life. And that's one of the challenges. I think that's why we don't see farm animals so much in Japan, is because people, they'd like to go out, they'd like to travel a bit more, or they don't want to have the responsibility, because it's big.
Yeah, for sure. Have you had any luck with getting volunteers on the farm? So, for example, using organizations like WWF or other international organizations where you come, people come and stay and help you do work on the farm?
Actually, not so much. And recently, I mean, before I had other locations people could stay, but right now I don't really have locations for people to stay. So a one day volunteer has, does a one day volunteer kind of program has come up, but actually I've been doing more tours and workshops. So just this week there was a woman who came out who wants to start her own farm, and this was a tour slash workshop. I taught her how we farm and what we do, and she in exchange paid for the time and the education or the tour that we provided. So I'm gonna stick more with that, I think, going forward for volunteers. And I think my space isn't that big to where I would require that. Now, this new plot and this new space, we've got the students that will be helping, so I would consider that as like the additional hands to help with the farm. But right now, I'm able to manage the farm and without, kind of more or less without it. And sometimes I might prefer that. I do get messages and emails asking about it, because I think recent YouTube videos or other programs we've been involved with has highlighted some of the unique aspects of the farm, and people definitely want to come out. But at this point, I think I'll stick with this more tours and approach. I think it seems to work out a
Yeah,
little bit
and
easier.
that's so important too. You're teaching and inspiring more people to do their own farming as well. And anyone who even buys it from you, even visiting the farm, maybe has a spark of inspiration. They'll start growing something, right?
Absolutely. It seems like every time we have visitors or volunteer or visitors come to the farm, they can come away with some new found knowledge or information that they didn't have before. And it really does come from having your own experience. I studied sustainable agriculture in undergrad, but I didn't grow up farming or growing anything at all. And now I'm growing, hundreds of varieties of plants, and thousands of different plants are going to the field every year. And I really had zero experience, and it really is important to learn from that experience, to make mistakes, and to, educate yourself on what you want to grow and what you would like to do. And a lot of people can come, who to visit the farm can also leave with maybe new plants to take away and to plant themselves. And having such diversity and variety on the farm too inspires people a lot to show that it is possible. I think there's a lot of misconceptions around, organic and natural farming, and new using no pesticides, herbicides, fungicides to grow food. And I think some of those misconceptions can be, seen right in the field. So people coming out can get that firsthand knowledge, which is, I think, it's really important. But then also the valuing it, and not to say we need to commoditize every single thing that we do, but certainly having 15 years of experience, people who come and can understand the value, they're willing to pay for that. And I think that's something that service that we want to provide too. So it's something I'm, always in the beginning maybe a bit more hesitant to offer or to say, but I think I've gotten enough confidence in the last 15 years to say that I think it's worth it. These tours or these educations or workshops are certainly worth it.
Absolutely. I know that the people that I've organized with you to bring on tours and as part of sustainable tourism, so we cycle from Onomichi over to Mukaishima, and it's a beautiful part of the island that you're on. It's a less cycled area, but it's so beautiful. And then you take us on a little farm tour, and then we have a beautiful salad, light lunch at the end, and that works really well. It seems like you've got a great like area and location and ability to do that. I would love to see you do more of that if you have time.
Yeah, I think in the future there should be more. And you know, Hishio is actually developing, growing. We've seen a few restaurants pop up, several guest houses pop up. Just a month ago in the newspaper, it sounds like they're going to add a resort and hotel restaurant in the next several years. It's a new initiative by Onomichi City University. It seems like they found, and they're going to be utilizing abandoned space that, you know, hadn't been used in years. And I think this is good. Growth is good in that sense. And it's not going to be a luxury hotel, but it's going to be, you know, a smaller space. And it's because the place is really beautiful. We face the eastern part of the coast, so we get beautiful sunrises. And right now, the local fishing cooperative has recently done some crowdfunding to get their shell or kai production back up. So after 6 years around Corona, they didn't have these workshops or tours where guests would come in and harvest the shellfish at all. And now they've recently started, and I see several hundred people every single week for the last 3 weeks lining up to get in and get their shellfish, and you know, it's amazing. So Hishio's growing, and it's a beautiful area, like you said. And yeah, I think we'll see more and more opportunities growing in the future, whether it's at the sea or at the farm or somewhere in between.
That's awesome. I remember you saying sometimes you would just go out to the nearest island, mm-hmm. and there were some wild oysters, and do some fishing. Have you ever thought about cultivating seaweed as an extension of what you're doing? Because you're right there on the coast.
Yeah, I've definitely collected some seaweed for compost in years past. But I think, you know, like technically, if you were to go and pick it up, you'd need some kind of license to sell it, or you need to join the kumiai or the cooperative, the group. And I haven't joined them. I know several of the guys that are a part of it. I mean, I certainly think, like, you know, there's been a big issue this year here in Hiroshima with oysters. And I think we often in Japan, we have the Seto or the Satoyama, Sato Umi, right? And Satoyama is the village, you know, connection between nature and the farms and agriculture and all. And then the Sato Umi is the village connection with the sea. But we don't really place these two together. And I think we have to really bring these two groups closer and closer together, because they work in flow or in combination with each other all the time. And it's just it's something in Japan that I think the Ministry of Agriculture, Forest, and Fisheries really has to bring these groups together, because they are somewhat separated. And I think we could do a bit more in Japan about that. I would certainly consider it. I'm not very good at fishing, though, and I'm not much of a fisherman. I was out this last Golden Week, tried to go fishing, and I'm not. I don't know.
Well, I had the chance to be a part of a discussion between a sustainable oyster farmer brought over from Maine, mm-hmm. who is a scientist, and then she had a chance to try out her sustainable strategies in oyster farming. And she came over to Hiroshima, and she gave local oyster farmers some great advice about be growing kelp around the oyster farm to add nutrition, to reduce the heat of the water. Mm-hmm. You should really be using reusable baskets or bamboo. And so many of the things she suggested, I know that local oyster farmers say, oh, we used to do that 50 years ago, you mm-hmm. know? Like these are great strategies to bring back that were already in use in Japan. Yeah. And of course, you can sell seaweed. That's another income stream, right?
Right. I think there's been some initiative. I don't know if you've heard of this blue carbon initiative in Japan that they are trying to use carbon sequestration with certain varieties of traditional kelp seagrasses, and then they're selling those credits back to certain, or companies can purchase those credits, and there's some subsidies or governments support for this process. So it's the Blue Carbon Initiative, and I think that's starting to happen. I sometimes wonder how accurate these can be, really calculated. You know, how can they actually measure the carbon? You know, and I know that there are certain tools that they can use to measure how much is being taken back, but I wonder about these initiatives. But I think there are certain things that could be done more. Yeah, and you mentioned, yeah, this is what we were doing 50 years ago. And when I talked to my neighbors and asked them, and even the property that I'm growing on now, I grew nanohana or canola or rape flower this season. You know, they were like, "Oh yeah, we used to grow this." And then I'm growing wheat and barley, and the farmer's like, "Yeah, when I was, you know, a kid, we grew Hadaka olmugi, or which is naked barley. It's basically a variety that doesn't have a hull, so it's easier to process, produce, and then consume for your family." And they mix that in with rice. So this is something that, oh, we did that 50 years ago. My neighbors, they raised sheep 50 years ago. You find that they did that. And it's like we have to sometimes go back to go forward. And I think sustainability, we get a lot of hints from our past about how to live and how to grow food and how to have community again. And these are going to be essential, especially as there's greater and greater pressures on our economy and then our environment to create more and more opportunities.
So important. How self-sustaining are you able to live in terms of energy and water? And I would assume all of your food that you need comes from your farm. But in so many ways, whenever I visit your farm, you're always trying out these strategies. You have compost for the vegetables, but also you have compost toilet, right? You use some solar, you're catching some water. Of these strategies, if people are just trying to get started with more sustainable farming or more sustainable living, what do you think people could try and do quite easily to be more self-sufficient?
Yeah, I think food is always the first, because it's what we do every single day. It's always the first thing that you can start with. And it can be, we had customers come today, and or sorry, on Sunday, yesterday, and I asked them, "Oh, are you growing, you know, growing something?" Because we were talking about, you know, different plants, and they said, "Oh, we don't have a field. We live in an apartment, but we have some containers." Okay, so in that, one of the things they were really impressed by was just the freshness of mint that I had. And mint is a kind of a weed on my farm, so it grows everywhere. And they wanted to take some home, of course. And you know, mint is a great example of something you can put in a container and have. And if you look at the pricing of the supermarket from an economic sustainability standpoint, you know, you get a few sprigs of mint for 200 yen, I don't know, 300 yen maybe. And this is something that, yeah, you could have, you know, anytime. And it's something that you could be growing yourself, and doesn't really take much effort. It's a little bit of watering. So little things like that are really important. So herbs, growing your own herbs, because a lot of herbs are grown in either greenhouses, which require a lot of energy to heat, or plastic to cover, or technology, whether it's these days, a lot of greenhouses maybe are doing a lot more with AI and energy required just to keep the facility running, or water as well. Of course, then maybe they use more, less water, more self more sustainable in their water consumption, but still, you could be growing things like mints or basil or chives or green onions. I think Chuck mentioned green onions in his talk as well. These kind of crops are really great, and then other things like lettuces and greens are really great because they're very quick to your harvest. So the days to harvest or time to harvest is much faster. Smaller radishes are also great and can be grown in containers. And then other things that people can be doing. I mean, we did put in some solar in the past, and there's to do a DIY solar setup like we've got has come with some technical issues that we've had, and we're not able to use as much as I'd like to. And then in Japan, I've found that if you go with a company, they want to install the panel. So we'd already purchased panels ourselves. So if we wanted to reuse the panels that we've currently got and install like a battery or look at like a power wall or one of the Kyocera's battery backups, I think that would be great in the future, but we're not really there right now. And those companies all want to sell you the whole kit, the panels, the power wall, the installation costs. So it's not really within our range right now. We have a well on the property, but actually we really prided ourselves on off-grid, you know, living for a while. But last year we got city water, and part of it is because we run into issues with water in August and September, especially the last several years. We had the shortest rainy season that I've ever experienced, a 2-week-long rainy season last year. And it's just not enough water. So for a lot of the household things, we use our city water. And for everything in the garden, we can use for our well and the water that we save. And that's really great. But it's a lot about a lot of things with sustainability is having backups and having multiple outlets for your lifelines, essentially, water, food, shelters, these kind of essentials. For your life or something you can look into, and even having small scale solar or backup generators or things, because Japan does deal with some of these major disasters. Natural disasters do come, typhoons, power outages, so having like little backups like that just add to what's considered maybe sustainable, but also they add as a lifeline in the case of some issue or emergency, which yeah, it's something to consider so that you're more resilient and helpful in those times for your friends, your family, and your neighbors.
Absolutely. And I know that you do so much with your community, mm-hmm. Collaboration, as well as education, as mm-hmm. well as doing so much on your own, of course, running an organic farm. Thank you so much, Thomas, for sharing all your insights.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I'm looking forward to seeing you on Sunday.
Yeah, it'll be great. I think looks like good weather the next few weeks. So looking forward to having you out.
Yeah, it'll be nice. I'll share some short videos from the farm. Please do. See what you're growing right now and give more updates from the farm. But thank you, as always, for joining today and sharing your deeper insights. I hope your students appreciate having such a wonderful teacher. Anybody watching the video from Thomas's class, you can get bonus points if you quote that.
Yep. Please do. Yeah.
Right? All right. Thanks, everyone, for watching. See you again next time. Thanks, Thomas.
Thank you. Bye.